Hello, I'm Jacqueline Wilson. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're celebrating some outstanding books for children and young adults. We've got the winner of this year's Silip Carnegie Medal.
I'm thrilled to bits. I'm absolutely thrilled to bits.
Robert Kirkwood mixes with dragons and aliens amid the friendly surroundings of a Scottish jamboree.
It's really to foster a love of reading and writing and engagement with the world of books for everybody, but particularly for children.
Philip Pullman reveals the books of his life.
I know nothing like it in children's literature or any other kinds of literature. It's a classic and I'm sure it'll still be read with delight in 50 years' time.
And Sarah J. Harris gives us another peek behind the scenes of The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The Silip Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest prize for books written for children and young adults. Now in its 81st year, it is presented by the Chartered Institute of Librarians and is open to authors writing in English around the world. Past winners include many of the best-known names in children's literature, including Arthur Ransom, C.S. Lewis, Frances Harding and Philip Pullman. The 2018 winner was announced this week in a ceremony held at the British Library, and I was lucky enough to be there.
Okay, so the winner for the Silip Carnegie Medal is Geraldine McCorcoran.
Geraldine McCorcoran, many congratulations on becoming the Silip Carnegie 2018 winner.
I'm thrilled to bits. I'm absolutely thrilled to bits. I won it 30 years ago. And I really, really, really wanted to win it again in that way that I felt really quite ashamed of.
Our librarian Lynn Livingston has just presented you with your Braille copy. What will you do with that?
Oh, it will have a place of honour. When I've got my house back, which is being demolished and rebuilt at the moment because of flooding, I will have books back again and I'll be able to put them on my non-existent bookshelves when all the furniture comes back out of store. So it's going to have pride of place because it's so beautiful. I've got a few pages of Braille that I was given many years ago on brown, very brown paper. Like it almost looks like cardboard, but this is pristinely white and very, very beautiful. It looks like something carved in plaster. It looks like plaster dado. And it's just gorgeous. I'm so thrilled to have it.
Where the World Ends is very much a story about survival in the face of the elements and what draws people together as much as what drives them apart. And it's certainly got a message for the 21st century. Are you surprised that a book that goes so far back in history has won rather than the book that deals with current events?
Yes, to be honest, I was astonished. Not so much to be shortlisted, although I mean that was a fantastic honour and unexpected. But among the others that were there that did have contemporary relevance, I thought, well, yeah, mine is about the past. It's an adventure, but it's set in the past, and it doesn't have really any relevance to people nowadays whose lives are so utterly, utterly different. Isolation, yes. Desperation, yes. Friendship, the power of story. Those things are universal and eternal. But all the same, I was not expecting it to win.
If readers take one thing away from the book, what would you want them to take away?
Oh, the power of story, I think. The consolation of story and the fact that everybody needs to keep an interior world where they can go when they're sad, when life's being unkind, when they need to feel good about themselves. Because in the imagination, you can gift yourself all of those qualities that you would like to have in real life. You can be popular and brave and physically magnificent and heroic. And you can be a horse, you can be a spaceman, you can be anything you like inside your imagination. And whether or not you read, regardless of whether you read, your imagination is a fantastic and underrated resource.
And finally, you made a rather impassioned acceptance speech about the dumbing down of language. Could you just reprise a little bit of that?
I did, didn't I? Yes. Anne Fine says you must be sure your speech is about something. So I made sure that it was about something. But I didn't want to sound ranting because it was hardly the situation to be ranting. I just feel very strongly that Carnegie today demonstrates that you can still and probably should still match the language to the subject and craft the style in which you present your thoughts. It's simply a matter of taste. Some people really don't mind about style. Some readers don't mind about style. They're simply after a story. But I think it's a bit like cooking, really. It's nice when the food that you serve up is not only nutritious, but it looks nice on the plate. So I try and write so that the sentences are pleasing in themselves, and that readers will meet new words that maybe they haven't come across before, because new words are like new friends, and they will sit in your head forever, and they will be your means of expressing yourself just as I expressed myself in the first place.
Well, I'm sure all of us and the many more readers who will be attracted to read you after you're winning the Sir Carnegie Medal will enjoy devouring your books in the future.
Very kind of you to say so. I hope so. Thank you.
Congratulations again to Geraldine McCorkeran. Like all the books on the Sir Carnegie shortlist for this and previous years, Where the World Ends is available in Braille, giant print and as a talking book from the RNIB Library. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Sarah J. Harris on face blindness and Philip Pullman on the classic detective story that encouraged him to write. But first, it's not just me that's been out and about this week. Robert Kirkwood found himself mixing with some of the most entertaining characters in children's books.
Dragons this size are normally fairly harmless to man, but in these numbers they will set upon you like piranhas. There'd be nothing left of even a fatso like you, Warty Hog.
My name is Tracy Beaker. I am 10 years, 2 months old.
It's my baby brother. I think he's from outer space.
Behind them, a cockatoo was talking into a telephone.
Well, I'm very sorry, madam, but that's company policy.
The cockatoo was saying.
The Scottish-friendly children's book tour takes the very best UK and international authors directly into schools across Scotland and the UK to inspire a love of reading and writing. Top authors go on tours through Scotland and in England, visiting a vast range of different communities, from rural schools with 8 pupils to 400-seat theatres in the city. It's been running for 20 years, and to celebrate that fact, there was a jamboree in the Glasgow Royal Concert Hall, attended by authors such as Jacqueline Wilson, Cressida Cowell, and Pamela Butchert, and a lot of children.
We are so excited that you are all here. There are over 2,000 children in this room. Can you go, what?
Mark Lambert is the CEO of the Scottish Book Trust. I asked him what the Scottish Book Trust's mission was.
It's really to foster a love of reading and writing and engagement with the world of books for everybody, but particularly for children.
And you not only promote reading, you also promote writing as well.
Yes, we do. We have a number of young writer programmes and programmes also for emerging writers, and that's a very important part of what we do as well.
Now, we can hear a lot of children in the background. Why are we here today?
Well, there are 2,000 kids streaming in from all across the country. They've arrived in 51 buses, and there are 71 schools represented. So it's all a bit mad, but it's wonderfully mad, and as you can hear, there's a wonderful atmosphere. And today they're coming to see an all-star lineup of children's authors, which is a celebration of 20 years of Scottish-friendly sponsorship for our Touring Authors programme. Many kids around the country don't get the chance to meet a well-known children's author, and so what we do with Scottish Friendly Support is to bring them around. We have a book bus and we tour them right across Scotland. Sometimes they go to small rural schools, sometimes they go to larger schools in urban areas, and sometimes they all come together for jamborees like this one.
And it's going to get noisy later on. What authors are here?
Well, we've got a really fantastic lineup: Jacqueline Wilson, Chris Riddell, Pamela Bookhart, the Etherington brothers, Cressida Cowell. It's just amazing.
And many of those authors are in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Let's have a listen.
I got fed up with this and put 2091 in my day book and wrote about all these rockets and spaceships and monsters legging it down from Mars to eat us all up, as if we'd all whizzed 100 years into the future. Miss Brown didn't half get knocked.
In a few minutes, I want you to take one of these baskets and start climbing the cliff, commanded Gobber the Belch. Once you are at the cave entrance, you are on your own. I am too large to squeeze my way into the tunnels that lead to the dragon nursery. You will enter the cave quietly!
We'll hear from the authors of some of those books in a moment, but first a word from our sponsors. Scottish Friendly have supported the book tour for 20 years. I asked Callum Benny, the communications manager at Scottish Friendly, to tell me more.
Scottish Friendly is a friendly society. That is, it's an investment company. It's been in Glasgow for over 150 years now. We sponsor the book tour. We've been sponsoring it for the last 20 years. It's a way of giving something back to the community. Scottish Friendly has always been a company that's been very community-oriented. And the book tour is something that's really important because children's literacy is such a hot topic these days. We need to try and get more children reading and liking reading in a age that's very different in terms of books.
That was Callum Benny from Scottish Friendly. And we'll be talking to Jacqueline Wilson, Pamela Butchert and Chris Riddell in a moment. But first...
Hi, my name's Cressida Cowell and I'm the author and illustrator of the How to Train Your Dragon books and the Wizards of Once series. My dad was a businessman, so his job was in London, but his heart was in the wilderness. He was chairman of the Royal Society of Protection of Birds and, you know, later on when he retired, chairman of Kew Gardens. So what that meant was his heart was in the wilderness. And every year, from when I was a baby, we would be dropped off on this uninhabited island off the west coast of Scotland. An island so small that when you stand on the top of it, you can see all around you. Nothing on the island. No houses, no roads, no Tesco's. And we'd be picked up by a local boatman 2 weeks later. Extraordinary. It's just near Mull. Stunning, but extraordinary experience for a child. And from when I was nine, my dad had a house built on the island, still with no electricity, no mobile phones, and then he got a boat to catch fish to eat. So the Isle of Buck is a real place, and it's, of course, you know, the Inner Hebrides was the first place the Vikings came to when they invaded Great Britain and the last place they left. So the inheritance of the Vikings is steeped into those islands.
Once there was magic. It was a long, long time ago. In a British Isles so old it did not know it was the British Isles yet, and the magic lived in the dark forests. Perhaps you feel that you know what a dark forest looks like. Well, I can tell you right now that you don't.
That was Wizards of Once, as voiced by David Tennant. And there's a reason why the character Wish has an eye patch.
Yes, she has. She has an eye patch. I identify very much with Wish, who is the writer in the story. And she has an eye patch, I think, because I've struggled with my eyesight all my life. I still have a very bad astigmatism and early onset cataract. So I have struggled with my eyesight all my life.
Now, it's important for you that your books are available to everyone, regardless of their eyesight.
Absolutely. And I write these books to be read aloud. I write them to be read aloud, and they're read aloud, oh, I'm so lucky, by David Tennant. Both Dragon and Wizards of Once by David Tennant, because he makes the whole thing into a, you know, performance, and he does all the different characters. I mean, he's just marvellous. And I write them to be read aloud deliberately because it's such a... When you enjoy things together, it's such a brilliant way of getting children excited about reading. So I'm hoping they're going to be read aloud by parents or grandparents with their children, or enjoyed together in the car, or, you know, so I deliberately write them to be read aloud.
A good narrator can really lift a book.
Yeah. I mean, somebody who... David can do what I try and do in the books, which is make them funny and exciting, but emotional as well. He can do that. Listening to him record it is just an education in itself. He does it almost in one take. He'll go from, you know, a Glaswegian accent to a kind of Edinburgh accent to a kind of, I mean, to, he's just extraordinary. Just in one take, practically, he reads the whole thing. He's amazing.
I need not tell you, Gobor continued cheerfully, that if you return to this spot without a dragon, it is hardly worth coming back at all. Anybody who fails this task will be put into immediate exile. The hairy hooligan tribe has no use for failures. Only the strong can belong.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I listen to audiobooks a lot as a child. And so, yes, the rhythms of things like... I remember some of the books that were things like Just So Stories, Rudyard Kipling, and the rhythms of the grey, greasy Limpopo River. That sound of the language kind of... I can feel myself sometimes when I'm writing in that sort of way. Or Sherlock Holmes, I still remember the Hound of the Baskerville, the footsteps of a gigantic hound. It's so electrifying. I think it's because... Why does it resonate so much for us as humans? I think it's because for thousands of years of human history, people will have told stories by the fireside. You know, way before books were invented, the kind of written word, people would have told stories by the fireside, our ancestors. This is ingrained in human history. And human beings are very attuned to the voices, particularly of the voices of their parents, because the voice of your parent might tell you, don't eat those berries, you know, that day. You know, so we're very attuned to listening to voices. And so I think that sound of a story being told aloud is something that resonates with us, or it certainly does with me. It really speaks to something deep in us when a story is told to us.
Thanks to Cressida Kill. All of those books narrated by David Tennant are available commercially, and How to Train Your Dragon in the RNIB Talking Books Library is narrated by Anthony Ofwego. The next author I met at the Scottish Friendly Book Tour Jamboree is primarily known as an illustrator, but this book of his, Otoline and the Yellow Cat, is available narrated by David Thorpe.
So, where are you from, stranger? Said Roop the Fang. Nosey gave him his card. Roop looked at it. Norway, he said. It can get very wet in Norway. Nosey nodded and put a playing card on the table.
Emperor of Heligoland, said Butch Hilberg, chewing on his doggy treat. I once saw the Emperor of Heligoland wear a splendid hat.
Nosey nodded and played another card.
I've been on the Scottish Friendly Book Tour twice.
Former Children's Laureate, the author and illustrator Chris Riddell.
With a few years in between, the first time I travelled all round the western coast of Scotland and then down the east coast. And the second time I went through the sort of central belt. And both times it was just fantastic. Wonderful to be in a bus with Scottish Book Trust. It was a real team effort, and I had a wonderful time.
Now, you work in a very visual medium, but obviously one thing that blind and partially sighted children don't get are the illustrations. How important is it that your work is translated into audio?
I love audiobooks, and I love listening to stories, and I think stories absolutely are at their best when they're spoken. And I think the audio versions of books can be incredibly powerful. The sharing of books is a very intimate thing, and to actually listen to someone reading to you is one of the great pleasures, I think, that we all enjoy.
Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself? Not just children's books, but...
Yes, I do, often in the car. Sometimes books that I would not get round to reading. So, for instance, I listened to Herman Melville's Moby Dick being read by the most amazing American actor. All 26 discs of it. It was amazing. And so although I can't claim to have read Moby Dick, I've listened to Moby Dick, which I think is almost better.
Mm. Now, the Scottish Book Trust want to put a book basically in the hands of every child in Scotland. How important is reading for people of that age?
I think it is an amazing ambition to put a book into the hands of every child in Scotland. And what it says is, this book is special. You will enjoy this book. You know, just open up its pages, see what's in it, you know, and inhabit the story. And I think if children learn that reading is pleasurable, that reading for pleasure is one of the great gifts that we can bestow, they will become readers for life. And I think that's what we want. You know, rather than lots, I'm going to get political, rather than lots of testing and school league tables and all that sort of stuff, wouldn't it be great if we just encouraged our children to read for pleasure?
One of the children at the Scottish Friendly Book Tours Jamboree reading for pleasure was Damien Dunlop from Kilmacombe Primary School. He's visually impaired, so before I talked to Damien, I talked to his deputy head about what VI facilities were at his school.
Hi, I'm Lynn McPherson. I am the deputy head at Kilmacombe Primary School. We have got a visual impairment teacher for Inverclyde Council, and they come and regularly visit the class and visit the boys, and they provide different facilities and materials that they can help the boys see in the class. Within the class, we've got two pupils who have both got their own tablets, and the tablets have got enlargers so that they can get their work enlarged, but they also have a camera where they can be sitting positioned anywhere within the class, and they will be able to see the board and the teacher, and they will be able to get their work enlarged to make sure that they can see as well as anybody else in the class.
What's your name?
Gaming Gumlop.
And what primary are you in?
Primary 4.
So, of the authors who are here today, who did you like best?
Pamela Bookcock.
Do you like her books?
Yeah.
Has it inspired you to go away and write a story yourself?
No.
Oh.
Do you think it has?
Yeah.
So here's Damien's favourite.
My name's Pamela Butcher, and I write The Spy Who Loves School Dinners, and my head teacher is a vampire rat. I was on the tour and we went down to kind of like just the line between going into England, and we did all the little schools all up and down there, and it was absolutely wonderful. I think we did something like, well, we did a lot. I think we managed to hit something like 40 schools in 5 days. It was absolutely wonderful. And some of the schools that we went to were just teeny little community schools where all the schools together, everybody was only like 14 pupils. It was wonderful. It was awesome.
Now, your books are narrated by Susan Kalman. How important is it that your books are available in audio?
I think it's really important that the books are available in audio. It's, well, before I ever started writing my stories down, I was an oral storyteller. I would say that's how my grandma would tell me stories and my mum would tell me stories, and I would hate to think that there's a barrier for some, you know, children and pupils not to be able to kind of have all these wonderful stories that we have. You know, everything from Jacqueline Wilson to Treasure Island to kind of modern day greats like, you know, Mr. Gum and such. So it's wonderful to know that there are no barriers when it comes to books, if we have as many books as possible, audiobooks. And having Susan Kalman narrate and do the audiobooks for the Izzy series is just hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. I wonder how it would work, because Izzy is an 8-year-old child. But no offence, Susan, but she does a brilliant job of being an 8-year-old.
After seeing your performance today, I know Susan does a brilliant job, but have you ever thought about narrating any of your own books?
In an ideal world, if I could actually sit down and have that sort of discipline and not go off on a tangent and tell this story and this story, I would love to read my own books. But I think I'd have to leave that to Susan. I think that I would get a bit jumbled reading out loud. I do. And I think that I would get a wee bit too excited, and I'd end up stopping and telling a story much as I'm doing now. I've been very good today, I think. So best left with Susan, I think.
Those books narrated by Susan Kalman are available commercially. In the RNIB Talking Books Library, however, are Baby Aliens Got My Teacher, The Magic Hamster, and The Baby Brother from Outer Space. It's read by Olivia Mace.
Maisie fainted instantly because she is terrified of aliens, and one time when we thought our teacher, Miss Jones, was an alien, she actually fainted head first into her shepherd's pie at school dinners. That's how scared she was. So me and Zach picked Maisie up by an arm and a leg each, and Jodie said, "Den, now." But I said, "What about Haroon?" Because it's only me and Jodie and Zach and Maisie that know about the den and are allowed to have secret meetings there.
And finally, another former Children's Laureate who was in attendance at the Scottish Friendly Book Tours Jamboree was Dame Jacqueline Wilson.
I feel I'm a veteran of the Scottish Book Trust tours, and they're always beautifully organised, and I feel we go way back, both of us, and so I'm very, very happy to be here on their 20th anniversary.
Now, during your talk today, you said something I've not heard before about how Tracy Beaker got her name.
Well, I was trying to think of the right surname for Tracy, and I was actually doing it in my bath. And when you think about it, bath time and bathrooms are a very great place for surnames. And I was looking all around and thinking, shall I call her Tracy Tap, Tracy Toothbrush, Tracy Toilet? The ideas got darter and darter. So I got on with shampooing my hair, and to rinse it, I keep an old plastic beaker on the side of the bath, picked it up to sluice my hair clean, and thought, oh my goodness, Tracy Beaker. And that is how she got her name. I think this is always a good story to tell the children because it always makes them giggle, but it actually happens to be perfectly true.
In the RNIB Talking Books Library, we've got a lot of classic literature. And do you think children's literature has changed over the years? And do you think you've been a part of that change?
I think it certainly, when I was young, I did feel that lots and lots of books were very much about middle-class children and their experiences. And I thought, well, that's not what my life's about. And so I did think, if ever I was lucky enough to be an author, that's the sort of child that I would write about.
And is it important that your books are available in all formats so people can read it regardless of their site?
Absolutely, and I signed something special to make sure that my books would be in sort of large format and a very special sort of recorded format for blind and partially sighted children. And I've taken part in various campaigns to try and make this available for as many children with sight problems as I possibly can.
If I was older, I would live in this really great modern house all on my own, and I'd have my own huge bedroom with all my own things, special bunk beds just for me, so that I'd always get the top one, and a Mickey Mouse alarm clock like Justine's, and my own giant set of poster paints, and I'd have some felt tips as well, and no one would ever get to borrow them and mess them up, and I'd have my own television and choose exactly what programmes I want, and I'd stay up till gone 12 every night, and I'd eat at McDonald's every single day, and I'd have a big fast car so I could whiz off and visit my mum whenever I wanted.
A clip from The Story of Tracy Beaker, which is in the RNIB library book, The Jacqueline Wilson Collection. It's narrated by Joanna Myers, and there are many Jacqueline Wilson books in the library. For more information on the RNIB library and Talking Book Service, phone the helpline on 0303 123 9999, or visit rniblibrary.com. And for more information on the Scottish Book Trust and the Scottish Friendly Book Tour, head to scottishbooktrust.com.
Thanks, Robert. Sounds like it was quite a jamboree. For more information on accessible copies of the books featured in this week's show, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we discover the titles of the books of Philip Pullman's life, Sarah J. Harris's new novel, The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder, is a cracker. It's a psychological thriller told from the point of view of a 13-year-old boy called Jasper, who has synesthesia, a condition that means he sees sounds as colours. He also suffers from face blindness and is quite possibly the only witness to his neighbour's murder. However, having seen the colour of her screams, He believes that he may well be the killer himself. It's a forensic study of what it's like to experience the world differently, and it's meticulously researched. In a series of podcasts, Sarah reveals the story behind The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder.
Hi, my name is Sarah J. Harris, and this is The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder podcast, a three-part series exploring the conditions of synesthesia and face blindness, which both feature in my novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. On this second episode, I want to explore the world of face blindness. This is a condition that Jasper has alongside synesthesia in my novel. It means that Jasper cannot recognise faces, even familiar ones. It makes the simplest of interactions much more difficult.
When he speaks, the rusty chrome orange of Richard Chamberlain's voice pummels my eyeballs. But if he walked up to me in the street, I wouldn't be able to recognise him unless I'd memorised a distinctive detail. The make of his watch, a hat, socks featuring a character like Homer Simpson, or the colour of his voice. Those are the kinds of things I look for first, rather than hair colour or styles that change whenever people run their hands over their heads.
I met up with Emmeline May, who has face blindness just like Jasper, and she talked me through living with the condition. Hi Emmeline, thank you very much for coming with me today. We're standing outside Shoreditch High Street Station. If you were meeting a friend here, can you describe what this situation would be like for you? Would it be quite stressful?
Yeah, if it's somebody I know super, super well, and I know they haven't recently changed their hair, I'd probably be all right. I quite often ask people what they're wearing. So I'd be like, I am standing to the right of Shoreditch High Street Station as you come out, to the left of the recycling bin, in front of a big lorry, to the right of this particular piece of graffiti. So I'd be really specific about where I am. Or if other people are already there, I'd ask them to be really specific about where they are so I can go to the location. And then I know that the person standing in that exact spot is probably them. And when I've done online dating, usually people haven't heard of it. I went out with one guy who had heard of it, and in fact he had it. And we had this fantastic conversation over tea and cake about all of the different things we did to try and recognise people and sort of the difficulty of being two face blind people who've only ever seen a picture of each other online, who don't really look like their pictures, who aren't going to recognise each other from their pictures, and how we'd both been extremely specific about, we are going to go to this cafe, I will be waiting outside, I will be wearing this jacket, and I still managed to walk right past him. And he didn't really say anything to me because he wasn't 100% sure who he was. So I ended up standing on opposite the cafe and messaging going, this is a bit weird, but are you the person standing outside the front wearing this shirt? And I just went, oh my God, is that you standing opposite with the purple hair? Yes, it's me. Okay. And then I kind of came over the road and we're like, hello.
Have you had the same experiences with family members as well, that you don't recognise them?
Mum and I managed to walk right past each other once. And when I was really little, I used to get really panicky in shops, like shopping centres. I remember that Marks and Spencer is a really frightening place when you're five and you have face blindness and you don't know it. Because you're bored and you're a kid and you wander off and you sit by the window, or you do the thing where you go inside the clothes and hide and then come out. The number of times I've gone inside clothes to hide and popped out and the person there was not my mum.
So when were you first diagnosed with face blindness?
I got a formal diagnosis in 2015, so 3 years ago. That was after I did the Cambridge face memory test online and got something like 52%.
Which is quite low.
Which is apparently quite low. And sort of within a couple of hours, I got an email from Bert Beck saying, hi, you got a really low score on your face blind test. Would you like to come in for research? And I was like, yes, I would. And I went in a few weeks later, got a whole battery of diagnostic tests, one which involved looking at horses and seeing if I could recognise different horses.
And could you?
I could recognise different horses. Could I recognise different cars? That one I struggled with because I don't really speak car. And another one where you had to recognise different houses. And then they're all kind of control tests just to make sure you can recognise objects. And then they show you different faces. And then they do the Cambridge memory test as well. And they do another one with the famous faces, where they take away the hair. So you're literally just looking at a face. And that was that was quite embarrassing, because I didn't recognise the Queen.
No.
I didn't recognise Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney. It was super famous people, I just didn't recognise them.
And how difficult do you find it in films, trying to identify people?
One thing I worked out is that one of the reasons I don't like James Bond films or big ensemble movies like that is everyone in them kind of looks the same, and a lot of the time the twists rely on you recognising the person that has double-crossed to the other person. I spend a lot of time watching those films going, I literally have no idea what's going on, who any of these people are. Why is the music going, duh? What just happened? And people have to explain to me that that guy who just double-crossed that other guy was the same guy that was helping him earlier. And I'm like, oh, can't follow them.
And did you find it reassuring when you got your diagnosis of face blindness?
It was so reassuring. It's like a moment of the realisation that you're not just rubbish. You're not just a rubbish friend who doesn't try hard enough to remember people, or you're not just forgetful. Or I think people have sort of thought of me as a bit standoffish or a bit rude because I wouldn't always speak to them. But it's just because I didn't recognise them.
And do you think it would have helped if you'd had an early diagnosis at school?
It probably would have done, actually. I think I was kind of quite a solitary child. I think, you know, everybody kind of looks the same in school uniform. And I guess then you don't know that you're any different. You just assume as a child that everyone has the same experiences as you do. You don't think that the way you're experiencing life is different to the way anyone else is experiencing life. And I think if I knew that I was walking around not being able to tell all these people one from the other in a way that other people weren't, perhaps I'd have got more help, I'd have been able to make friends more easily, or rather not annoy friends that I was making so much. Mm. There's probably a better way of putting it.
But it's quite easy to offend somebody if you have face blindness.
It's really easy to offend someone. Mm. And that's why I think I've got into the habit now of just saying, especially now I can't use excuses like, oh, I'm really drunk. It's just easier just to say, I'm really sorry, it's nothing personal. I have a neurological condition that means it's really difficult for me to remember faces. We've probably known each other for 10 years and you're probably really, really offended. Please don't be offended. Just remind me of your name. And if they say their name and it's a really generic name, like Dave, I know like 10 Daves, my brain will have to flick through all of the Daves and the little prefixes I have for them in my head, like Work Dave, Dave, Viking Dave, Fuzzy Dave, Dave with the long hair, Skinny Dave, Less Skinny Dave, until it kind of arrives on the right Dave.
And how would you describe the condition to somebody who doesn't have it? What it's like for you? Say we're standing on the street at the moment on Vic Lane. Well, it's very busy. There's lots of people walking past us, wearing kind of coats, jeans.
Instead of thinking we're on Brick Lane, imagine we're in Epping Forest. And I've asked you to identify one specific tree. And we go for a big walk and we come back and I go, right, which tree? And you're going to really struggle unless you picked a tree that is really unusual looking. For example, in Epping Forest, on the edge of Hollow Ponds, there's one tree which is, it's dead. And it's this big, black, dead tree. And it quite often has ravens sitting on it. If you'd picked that tree, it would be easy for you to go, that's the one tree I decided to identify. But you'd have chosen it because it's unusual looking and because it's got specific features you'd know you could remember. But most of the time, trees are just trees. And unless you're some kind of tree expert, you're not going to be able to pick one from the other. So it's a bit like, just imagine every single one of these people is a tree.
Is that quite stressful?
Yes. I hate crowds. Meeting people in large groups or public places like this, I find very difficult unless there's a very specific location.
So you try to avoid a scenario like this?
I would try to avoid meeting someone in a very sort of dense, busy area. So when someone says, oh, right, we'll just aim for this place and we'll text each other when we get there. And I'm like, we'll find each other as we walk around. I'm like, no. No, we will not.
So you'd never meet somebody in a bar now, would you?
No. No, unless it was like a blind date situation where I had a picture of what they were wearing that exact moment, if they'd sent me a picture. So that's one thing. Like, people make the joke about Clark Kent and Superman, how everyone ought to know that Clark Kent is Superman, because all it is one of them wears glasses and one of them doesn't. But if you're all face blind, You'd never know that Clark Kent was Superman, because as far as I'm concerned, one of them wears glasses, one of them doesn't. They're completely different people. Mm. So, you know, I'm maybe Lois Lane has prosopagnosia. That's why she never notices.
My name's Rachel Bennett. I'm a lecturer in psychology at Brunel University in London.
Rachel is an expert in face blindness. I was interested to hear more about the condition.
I'm particularly interested in individual differences in recognition. So that basically means why some people are really, really good at that task. You know, they basically never forget a face, whereas other people really, really struggle. And for those individuals who really, really struggle, sometimes we call that prosopagnosia or face blindness. Sometimes people will develop prosopagnosia after some sort of brain injury or illness. There's not one area of the brain that is responsible for face recognition. There's a whole network, probably at least 5 or 6 different areas and all the different connecting bits between them. On the other hand, some people, they grow up and they simply never learn to recognise faces. So we call that developmental, or some people call it congenital prosopagnosia, because we think there might be a little bit of an inherited element to it.
And do you know how common developmental prosopagnosia and acquired prosopagnosia are?
Within the population, it's surprisingly high incidence of developmental prosopagnosia. So a lot of people don't believe me when I say this, but it's around 1 in 50 individuals. So if you think of your standard kind of medium-sized office, or if you think of a school class, we're talking about a number of different people there who would have quite severe problems recognising the individuals around them. For acquired prosopagnosia, it's a lot less common. But among people who do have some sort of brain injury, problems with face recognition are quite frequent. Some studies have put the frequency of up to 80%.
How can prosopagnosia affect a person's relationships and day-to-day lives?
Some people figure out ways to kind of work around their face recognition difficulties. They might have specific strategies, particularly in workplaces, to make sure that it's not a big issue in their daily lives. For example, some people are very rigorous in meetings about making sure that everyone has name tags or everyone has a set spot to sit. However, that can be a lot more difficult in settings like schools for children. So schools can be a bit of a nightmare for people with prosopagnosia, because if you think about all the different cues that we might use other than the face, so for example the way someone's dressed or a specific hairstyle or maybe their jewellery, a lot of those things they're not allowed to be expressed differently in schools, especially those with very strict uniform codes. And obviously that can have a really quite serious knock-on effect. It can mean it's a little bit socially isolating for the children.
And that's how teachers could help with having some kind of support methods to assist these children?
Most definitely, yes. So one of the most obvious ones would be just getting kids to design and wear name tags, even just for the first couple of weeks of term. Also things like having a standard seating plan so that the same children are sitting in the same spots each different time. Schools might also consider allowing some of the children who are friends with individuals with prosopagnosia to wear some small identifying markers, like a ribbon in their hair or a ribbon on their wrist or something, just to make it a little bit easier.
And are there any treatments for face blindness?
That's something that researchers are currently working on. So we're trying to develop programs which will essentially retrain people in how they look at faces and how they process them to be a little bit more like typical individuals who can recognise faces relatively well. So a lot of those programs are a little bit like the brain training programs that you might know from your phone or computer. So essentially it's a matter of doing the same task over and over again, starting quite easy with really easy to discriminate faces, and then making it harder and harder and harder to train people to look at exactly the right areas of the face, because we think that's one of the things that might be going wrong in many cases of prosopagnosia. Beyond that, we've also been working with other things to try and figure out how to make that training more effective. For example, some of the research we've done has suggested that the hormone oxytocin, which some people refer to as the love hormone, although it's got a lot of other functions as well, a little bit of that might help face recognition very temporarily. So we're trying to figure out if there's ways to maybe combine our training programs with other techniques to make them much more effective.
And what should somebody do if they think they have prosopagnosia, or if they think a relative, such as a son or daughter has prosopagnosia, what should they do?
At the moment, there's no official kind of medical diagnosis of prosopagnosia. So most people, if they suspect they have issues with faces, the best way to investigate that is to go through university labs and researchers who are researching the condition. For example, there's a website called prosopagnosiaresearch.org, and you can register on there. You can register yourself or your register saying that you think your child has an issue. And we try to contact most of the people on there and set them up with researchers in their area. And we've got specialised tests for children as well. So it's a little bit more gamified rather than having them sit there and do just boring memory tests all the time.
Thank you so much to Rachel for talking to me all about face blindness, a really fascinating insight into the condition. My novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder, is available in audiobook, hardback and ebook from all good retailers. In the next episode, we'll be exploring some of the events in my book.
And remember to tune in next week when Sarah will discover what teenagers who have face blindness and synesthesia think of her book. Have you discovered a book that has made you see the world from a different point of view? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share. Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Philip Pullman's novel Northern Lights not only won the Carnegie Medal, but was crowned the all-time Carnegie of Carnegies in 2007. Now, 17 years on, Philip Pullman is back with a new trilogy, The Book of Dust. The book has recently entered the RNIB library in Braille, giant print, and as an RNIB talking book, which is narrated brilliantly by Michael Sheen. Here's a taster.
Apart from Professor Papadimitriou, almost her only contact with the service was the acorn. She gathered it with its query and left it with her reply in one of a number of different hiding places Oakley Street called Left Luggage Boxes. The person who left it for her and took it away again, the late Mr. Luckhurst, was known as an insulator. Neither of them knew the other, which meant that they wouldn't be able to reveal anything if questioned.
Michael Sheen narrating La Belle Sauvage by Philip Pullman, who came into the studio to share the books of his life. Philip Pullman, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
Was there a book that you read as a young man that made you want to become an author?
There were many. But the book I think that has stayed with me longest from the books I read as a child, not necessarily as a young man but as a child, was a book called Emil and the Detectives by Erich Kästner. This is a book that was given to me, I think, by my uncle or my aunt or somebody when I must have been about 8. It was translated from German, marvellous illustrations by Walter Trier. And it was set in the author's time, which is about the early 30s. And it's about a boy called Emil, whose mother is widowed. And she sends him off to Berlin to stay with his grandparents, with his grandmother, and puts some money in his pocket for him to take there. And on the train, the money's stolen. And when Emil arrives in Berlin, in this city where he's never been before, this huge, big metropolitan city with buses and trams and trains and all sorts of things going on, he's completely lost and bewildered. But he finds some other boys who help him. And by the power of friendship and working together and cooperation and the telephone, they manage to track down the thief and retrieve the money. And it's a wonderful story. I loved it at once for the simplicity of it and for the fact that In Emil, we have a hero who's good. And, you know, he's not one of these flawed, twisted, tormented people like we sometimes get in stories now. It seems to be the fashion. He's good. He's thoroughly good. But he's not boring. And that's something I appreciated then and appreciate still. There's a wonderful sequel to it, actually, called Emil and the Three Twins, which isn't much read or known about. And I wish it was, because I think it's even more wonderful than Emil and the Detectives.
You keep on talking about food and telephones and spending the night away from home and haven't said a word about how the thief is to be caught. You're a lot of gas bags.
He could not think of a worse insult.
Have you got any stuff for taking his fingerprints?
Asked Peters. He had seen so many thrillers at the cinema that it had rather gone to his head.
Of course,
he added. He may have worn rubber gloves, and then no one would be able to prove anything against him. Don't be an idiot, said Trout. We'll just have to keep an eye on him and wait for a chance to sneak the money back.
Oh, no, that won't do at all, exclaimed the professor. If we take the money from him like that, we shall be thieves ourselves.
Don't be silly, said Trout. If a chap pinches something from me and I pinch it back, that doesn't make me a thief.
It does, declared the professor.
I never heard such rot, growled Trout.
I think the professor's right, said Emile. If I take something away from someone without his knowing, that would make me a thief. It wouldn't make any difference whose property it was to start with. Yes, that's perfectly true, said the professor. And now, for goodness sake, stop trying to be clever. We've arranged everything we can. We can't know yet just how we shall catch him. We shall have to make plans for that as we go along. But of one thing I am certain, and that is that he must give back the money of his own accord. We'd be fools to try and steal it from him.
Matt Addis narrating Emile and the Detectives by Eric Kessner, which is TB20148. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread?
Yes, and it's not just a book, but a whole series of books. P.G. Wodehouse. The of all the writers of series, I don't know, I think of Arthur Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, all that sort of thing. P.G. Wodehouse is the one who consistently amuses me, consoles me even, delights me. And I think there are three reasons for that, and they're all quite different. First thing is he was a meticulous plotter. All his books are very cleverly plotted. They come together very skillfully, and you think, how's he going to fit this in? Oh, yes, how brilliant. That's marvellous. I wish I'd thought of that. The second thing is his wonderful way with metaphor. He jumped like an adagio dancer, surprised watering the cat's milk. You can't plan that out logically. It has to surprise you. I bet it surprised him. I bet he roared with laughter as he put that onto his typewriter. And the third thing, which it has something in common with Emil, Bertie Wooster, the hero, is consistently fun and interesting, but always good. He doesn't have an evil impulse in him. The only sin to which he's prone is the most forgivable of all, and that's vanity. He does enjoy his alpine hat or his old Etonian spats, despite the disapproval which Jeeves, his valet, looks on them. And always Bertie comes up with some ridiculous item of clothing that he thinks is the bee's knees, like his white mess jacket from Cannes or something. And always in every story, Jeeves manages to dispose of it before the end. It's flawless and never failing.
A wide selection of P.G. Wodehouse's work is available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats, including this adaptation of The Inimitable Jeeves, with a full cast including Michael Horden and Richard Briers, which is TB15110.
What was it you wished to ask me about, Mr. Leclerc?
Bingo. Oh, yes. He's fallen in love. He always does in the spring, with a waitress in a tea shop. You should have seen him, Jeeves, when she spoke to him. His entire map was suffused with a rich blush. He looked like the soul's awakening, done in pink.
I can well imagine it, sir.
Anyway, Jeeves, he wants to marry the female, but fears his uncle's wrath. So I thought we ought to rally round a trifle and help him put the thing through. Now tell me about old Mr. Little. What sort of chap is he?
Mr. Little has become a great recluse, and now devotes himself almost entirely to the pleasures of the table.
Greedy hog, you mean?
I would not, perhaps, take the liberty of describing him in precisely those terms, sir. He is what is usually called a gourmet, very particular about what he eats, and for that reason sets a high value on Miss Watson's services.
Miss Watson?
His cook, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
This is a Swedish book, written with children in mind, I suppose you could say. It's quite a long book. It's called The Murderer's Ape by Jakob Vigelius, which was a name I didn't know. But the publisher sent it to me, and I read it with curiosity, and found myself enchanted. It's told by a gorilla whose name is Sally Jones, and she's the ship's engineer, and she's very good at it. And through a series of mischances and chances, she's separated from her great friend, the captain, and there's a kidnapping, there's a chase, there's a all sorts of skullduggery, there are all sorts of mischief, and there are good friends, and there are evil people, and there are people who betray her, and there's a Maharaja who falls in love, and it's full of wonderful things. But all throughout the whole thing, it's sustained by the inventiveness of the author, Jakob Vergelius, and by the marvellous sense of affection between Sally Jones, the ship's engineer, the gorilla, and her friend, the captain. I know nothing like it in children's literature or any other kinds of literature. It's a classic, and I'm sure it'll still be read with delight in 50 years' time.
The Murderous Ape by Jakob Vergelius is available commercially in print, audio, and as an e-book.
The Murderer's Ape by Jakob Vergelius. Translated from the Swedish by Peter Graves. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. The other day, the chief gave me an old typewriter, a 1908 Underwood No. 5. He'd bought it from a scrap merchant down by the harbor, here in Lisbon. Several of the keys were broken, and the release lever was missing. But the chief knows I like fixing broken things. It's taken me a couple of evenings to mend my Underwood No. 5, and this is the first time I've written anything on it. Several of the keys still stick, but a pair of pliers and a few drops of oil will soon put them right. That will have to wait until tomorrow. It's already dark outside my cabin window. The lights from the vessels lying at anchor on the river are reflecting in the black water. I've strung my hammock, and I'm about to climb into it. I hope I don't have those horrible dreams again tonight.
Philip Pullman, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and books with the Read On listeners.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.